This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Happy New Year. We wrap up a week of our best interviews from 2010 and herald the new year with two female comics who broke barriers a generation apart. First, Sarah Silverman. Her fearless social comedy turns off some people, but has also won her devoted fans. On the surface, her comedy may seem offensive to Jews, African Americans, Latinos, gay people, but that's because she's in persona as someone who is clueless, uninformed but certain in her beliefs. Her Comedy Central series, The Sarah Silverman Program, ended a 3-season run this year. Not being shy about herself, Sarah Silverman titled her memoir, The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee. Terry Gross spoke to her last April when the book was published. A little later, we'll hear about the bedwetting problems that plagued her when she was growing up. But let's start with a clip from the Sarah Silverman Program. Sarah is in a restaurant at a table with her sister Laura, who is played by Silverman's real sister Laura, and Laura's boyfriend, Officer Jay McPherson, played by Jay Johnston.
Did you tell Sarah the news?
Oh, it's nothing.
Nothing? What, do you flipped your lid or something? Come on, tell her.
Well, I'm creating a Holocaust memorial for Valley Village.
How adorable is that?
Why would you have a memorial for something that never happened?
That's not funny, Sarah. You know, a joke like that just demonstrates that you don't understand what it really means to be a Jew.
I think I know what it means to be Jewish, Laura. Check this out. Excuse me. These pancakes are ishy.
Laura is right. You really should be more interested in the Holocaust. I mean, I'm not even a Jew. And I love the Holocaust. Love reading about it because it's so interesting and stuff. The things that happened.
You know, you should really think about becoming more invested in our history. You know, there's a great class that you can take.
Yon Kippur. You know, Laura, I am getting extremely bored at you and I will not tolerate it. Never again.
Sarah Silverman, welcome back to Fresh Air. So I have to ask you, are you good for the Jews or bad for the Jews?
I'm good for the Jews.
How do you know? How do you know?
I think that whenever a Jew has any kind of notoriety, good or bad, the Jews find it to be good. You know, it's like, you know, Son of Sam? Jewish. You know, like, so I think Jews tend to hold me in fairly high regard. I don't think that also because Jews tend to be able to take a joke. You know, it's kind of like there's a difference.
When it's coming from Jewish people.
Yeah. Or it's good-hearted.
I want to play another example of your humor. And this was, people might remember in the 2008 presidential campaign that in support of Barack Obama, you did a video called The Great Schlep to get out the older Jewish vote in Florida. And the excerpt we'll play explains the premise of The Great Schlep. So here it is. This is Sarah Silverman.
If Barack Obama doesn't become the next president of the United States, I'm going to blame the Jews. I am. And I know you're saying like, oh my God, Sarah, I can't believe you're saying this. Jews are the most liberal, scrappy, civil rightsy people there are. Yes, that's true. But you're forgetting a whole large group of Jews that are not that way, and they go by several aliases. Nana, Papa, Zadie, Bubby, plain old Grandma and Grandpa. These are the people who vote in Florida. And the Florida vote can make or break an election. If you don't think that's true, why don't you think back to two elections ago when a little man named Al Gore got by Florida. I'm making this video to urge you, all of you, to schlep over to Florida and convince your grandparents to vote Obama.
So that's Sarah Silverman. So what kind of reaction did you actually get from the two audiences that this was aimed at? The grandchildren who were supposed to convince their grandparents to vote and the grandparents who were supposed to be convinced to vote for Obama.
You know what? It was universally positive. It really was. I don't remember.
Wow. Have you ever had anything that was universally positive
before? No. And you know what? I mean, I said stuff like, get off your fat Jewish asses. And you know what I mean? It, like, I made, but I guess you're right. Coming from a Jew, you know, it eases the blow.
Okay, so you've titled your book The Bedwetter, and some of your book is devoted to the fact that when you were young, you used to wet your bed just about every night, which was a horrible humiliation for you, particularly for like sleepover parties, camping trips. How long did this last?
You know, I was a bedwetter until I was about 15. And it was humiliating. You know, I was sent to sleepover camp since I was six. And, you know, it's a recipe for disaster. And it's, but, you know, I guess the silver lining is there's not much to lose after that in life. You know, I think, you know, doing stand-up when I got a little older, the prospect of bombing was like, who cares?
You know, like, as long as you're not peeing on stage accidentally.
Please. Yeah.
So what did you do to cover up when you were young and you were in, and you were going to sleepover parties or summer camp?
A lot of it was just denial. I think I pretended it didn't happen more often than not. You know, at camp, I would just make my bed over it. I would take my clothes off and put it deep into the hamper, and I probably reeked of pee. And at sleepovers, I would kind of pinch myself awake and try to not drink anything too late. Eventually, your body gives in when you're a little girl, and you fall asleep even deeper than ever. So it was usually unfruitful, or fruitful in a bad way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sarah Silverman, and she has a new book called The Bedwetter: Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee. In your book, you write about how before you were born, your parents had a baby who died as an infant. The baby was staying over at your grandparents' house, mm-hmm. and got accidentally strangled in the crib. By the way,
yeah, it was a faulty crib, and it had broken, and the baby had slipped down into the corner and had suffocated in that space.
A really horrible thing. Did your parents talk to you about this as a child?
You know what? Maybe they did. The way I remember it is my oldest sister, Susan, who was older than Jeffrey, she knew the story, and we were all very young, and she kind of told my sister Laura and I, told it to us almost like a ghost story. You know, we were kids. And that chapter is actually called The First Time I Bombed, because it's about how my father taught me how to swear when I was little, and I saw how adults would be shocked, but give me approval. You know, I got approval from it, and it was addicting. You know, I saw this way that I could get approval, and I killed all the time, you know, as a very young kid. And I call that chapter The First Time I Bombed because my sister told us the story of Jeffrey, and shortly after my grandmother, who picked us up for our Sunday breakfast at a local diner, and she said, "Everybody buckle up." And thinking I was going to kill, I said, "Yeah, we don't want to wind up like Jeffrey." And just silence. And my sisters turned and looked at me like I was crazy. And my grandmother just burst into tears, which I'd never seen before. And I thought, what did I do? You know?
That interested me so much, since so much of your humor is about saying things that seem horribly inappropriate and potentially offensive. Mm-hmm. But it's not personal in the way that this is. I mean, your grandparents felt so guilty because the baby died at their home. And so this was hurtful in a way that your humor now is not. What did you learn from that experience?
I think, you know, I've been called edgy. But, you know, in all honesty, I think that there is a safety in what I do because I'm always the idiot. And unless you're listening to the buzzwords and not really taking into account the context or the content of it, you see that I'm the idiot always, the ignoramus in the scenario. So no matter what I talk about or what tragic event or, you know, off-color, dark scenario is evoked in my material, I'm always the idiot in it, you know.
Because you, your persona is the idiot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So can I ask you a personal question? Do you want to have children?
Probably. I love children. I'm embarrassingly baby crazy. I could be in the middle of any intense conversation, and if somebody walks by with a baby, I'm gone. You know, I'm not going to have a baby. You know, I happen to think that there are already tons of perfectly good babies out there already born. And I don't necessarily need to see a little me and, like, do it right this time. I'm already trying to do it right this time with me, you know. So I can see myself adopting. I'm not in a rush to do it. I'm 39, I know, but I do love kids, and I'm very good. I've got a lot of really good moves. Like a three-year-old girl, 3 to 5 or 6, I've got a really great move. This is what I do. I go, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell anybody. And I know you're not supposed to tell kids to keep secrets, but that's part of the rebellion. And then they go, okay. And I say, I'm a princess. But I dress normal because I want people to treat me regular. And their brains explode. It's really fun. And I went really far with it with my friends Sam and Nikki's daughter. I did that whole thing where I say, I'm a princess and don't tell anybody. And I said, when I come visit you in New York, I have some of my old princess stuff. It doesn't fit me anymore. Would you be interested in it? Yes. Yes, I would. So I came to New York and I bought a bunch of three-year-old, you know, size three little girl princess stuff. And I took it out of the package and mussed it up and put it in a trash bag and brought it over. That's the little pleasures.
Sarah Silverman, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's always exciting to be on Fresh Air with Terry Gross because I am an avid listener and fan.
Sarah Silverman's memoir is called The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee. Our next guest, Joan Rivers, is the subject of the documentary called Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. Rivers was one of the first really successful female stand-up acts, subbed for Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, and paved the way for many women comics. The documentary, though, is largely about what her life is like now, why she's driven to keep performing, and how she's had to reinvent herself in order to do it. The movie was shot over about 14 months during 2008 and 2009. Let's start with a clip from the documentary.
Age? It's the one mountain that you can't overcome. It's a youth society, and nobody wants you. You're too old, you're too old, you're too old. If one woman comedian comes up and says to me, you opened the doors for me, and you want to say, go f*** yourself. I'm still opening the doors.
That's Joan Rivers from the documentary about her called Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. It's out now on DVD. Terry Gross spoke to Joan Rivers last June when it was Joan's birthday.
Joan Rivers, welcome to Fresh Air and happy birthday. We're recording this on your birthday.
Thank you very much. Yes, we are.
And you've just turned 77.
Yeah, I know.
Ugh, you said, ugh, is that how you're feeling about it?
Well, no, I just don't believe what I am. And people say, what are you going to do on your birthday? I say, I'm 77. I'm going to get my 77th facelift. That's what I'm going to do.
So in the clip that we just heard, you talked about how you opened a lot of doors and you're still opening doors. And some of the doors that you opened earlier in your career, you were one of the first women comics to really make it, the first woman to host a late night show. And you also had different material. You made jokes about abortion, jokes about sex. You may have been the first famous woman comic to tell vagina jokes.
Probably. Yes, I'm sure I did. Uh-huh. I'm sure I have.
So what was it like early on when you were telling the kind of blue joke that other women were saying?
Well, I was the first one to discuss abortion, as you just said. And it was very rough. And we show in the film, I couldn't even say the word abortion. I had to say, she had 14 appendectomies.
No, wait. I'm going to stop you because I thought you said that because no one would say they had an abortion. People were always going away for like mysterious reasons. Oh, you know, she needed a vacation, or she had to get some minor surgery done.
She had an appendectomy.
She had an appendectomy. Exactly.
Everybody went to Cuba to get appendectomies, or went to Puerto Rico to get appendectomies. So I was the first one that dared to make jokes about it. And by making jokes about it, you brought it into a position where you can look at it and deal with it. It was no longer something that you couldn't discuss and had to whisper about. When you whisper about something, it's too big and you can't get it under control and take control of it. And that's what I still do.
So what did you have to say about abortion that first time?
Just that my friend had 14 abortions, and well, she was lucky because she was Jewish. She married finally one of the abortion doctors. It ended up happy for her mother. My daughter married a doctor.
So how did this kind of material go over?
Half the people would laugh, obviously, and half the people would go, I had another joke. I was having an affair with a married professor. And one of the jokes early on in my act is while he was engaged to me, his wife became pregnant, so I figured he wasn't sincere. And again, half the people laughed. But it was, you just didn't talk about things like that. It was never discussed. Even discussing that my mother wanted me desperately to get married and had to sign up. It sounds so silly now. She had to sign up last girl before freeway. And people said, you can't say that. You can't talk about things like that. But in those days, that was pushing the envelope. And it's so funny because I opened things for women that were then able to talk about.
Has what you think is funny or what you want to talk about on stage changed with age?
Good question. Changed tremendously with my age because I am so much freer now. Because I always say, what are you going to do? You're going to fire me? Been fired. I'm going to be bankrupt? Been bankrupt. Some people aren't going to talk to me? It's happened. Banned from networks? Happened. So I can say anything I want. And it has freed me totally. Totally. And I talk much more freely now than I ever dared to talk before.
So what can you talk about now that you wouldn't have dared to before?
Oh, I talk about terrorism. I talk about I was talking about 9/11 on 9/12 and talking about it, making jokes about it and how horrible it was, but making people laugh about it at the same time. I talk about how I truly, I hate whiners. If I live with a man for 9 years that had one leg, so I do a lot of things about how I use the term purposely, cripples. And if you're crippled, just get out of the room right now because I've had 9 years of pushing somebody around. And half the audience gets crazy and half the audience loves it because you're saying things people don't want to say. And it's never the person in the wheelchair. People in the wheelchair laugh about it. It's the people that are scared to face something and laugh about it and make it okay.
Can I just pick up on that and play an excerpt that I found really amazing from the documentary about you? And you're on stage doing comedy in Wisconsin, and
yes.
You're making a joke, and
Northern Wisconsin.
Thank you.
You know what I mean? Wisconsin with fir trees. Yeah, so Northern Wisconsin. Go ahead.
All right. So anyway, you're talking about children here, and I'll just let the clip play.
Oh, I hate children. The only child that I think I would have liked ever was Helen Keller because she didn't talk. It is just...
It is very funny.
Yes, it is. And if you don't, then leave.
It's funny if you have a deaf son.
I happen to have a deaf mother. Oh, you stupid ass. Let me tell you what comedy is about.
Go ahead and tell me.
Oh, please. You are so stupid. Comedy is to make everybody laugh at everything and deal with things, you idiot. My mother is deaf, you stupid son of a bitch. Don't tell me. And just in case you can hear me in the hallway, I lived for 9 years with a man with one leg. Okay, you ass. And we're going to talk about what it's like to have a man with one leg who lost it in World War II and then went back to get it, because that's littering. So don't you tell me.
what's funny?
So that's Joan Rivers in a clip from the new documentary about her, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. Wow, you really gave it to him.
But first of all,
by the way, I should say, in case people couldn't hear what he was saying, that's not funny if you have a deaf son.
Deaf son.
Yeah.
But that is funny because you, first of all, where are we going to start? I was doing a thing about noisy children, how I hate noisy children on an airplane. And then I said, the only child I would like would be Helen Keller. It's a joke. I'm a comedian. You've paid $60 to make you laugh. It's a silly joke. He obviously had such anger and emotion in him and took it so personally. And it just made me afterwards terribly sad. But you have to say to him, it's funny. It's okay. Your son would laugh at that. My mother at the end was deaf. Absolutely couldn't hear anything. And we used to laugh about it. And you laugh about it, you deal with it. You better deal with life and get over it and make it funny because otherwise it's so sad.
Joan Rivers speaking to Terry Gross last June. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Joan Rivers. She's the subject of the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, now out on DVD and Blu-ray. It follows her through a year of her life as she tries to get as many comedy and TV dates as possible in spite of her age. She turned 77 this year. When we left off, Rivers was talking about why she often finds comedy in life's painful events.
What are some of the most painful things that have happened to you that you've ended up making jokes about on stage?
Oh, Where do you start? My husband's suicide.
Right.
Some man, 60 years old, that couldn't take the business and went and killed himself. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that when you've got a 16-year-old daughter who gets the call? Huh? And I'll tell you how you deal with that. You go through it and you make jokes about it and you continue with it and you move forward. That's how you do it. Oh, that's how I do it. Everyone handles things differently. How do you make jokes about, how do you deal with bankruptcy? How do you deal with you're fired from Fox when your numbers were still good and you can't get a job for a year and a half? You do it. And I do it by making jokes.
Now, in the documentary about you, we see you booking as many dates as possible. Your schedule is just astoundingly complicated. You're always traveling from one place to another. You have like four things lined up in a day. I mean, I don't know how you deal with that amount of travel and work. I mean, most people would be trying to to decrease
Terry,
that a little bit. Yeah.
Go look at over the years who you've spoken to and see who has survived and who hasn't. And it's the ones that work and keep on working and take whatever there is to take that stay go. I will look at some of the people that were on my late night shows, that were on my daytime talk show, and you say, whatever happened to? You can't rest on your laurels. I hate to tell you, but Snooki from whatever that is, Jersey Shore, better get busy because Snooki ain't going to be around in 15 years unless Snooki understands she got to work. She can't sit around and expect a white limo to pick her up in 4 years.
No, there seems to be like two things really driving you. One, you know, driving you to like keep working extra super hard. One is that you love performing and you love being on stage and you want to keep being there. And the other is money. You want to maintain your lifestyle and that requires plenty of money. So does either of those two things take priority in terms of what's driving you to to work so hard?
Yes, unfortunately, I give up the lifestyle for the art, whatever the art is. I have always, they'll say to me, come do a play in San Francisco for 3 weeks in a little tiny theater called the Magic Theater that holds 90 people. Off and gone and running. I love the art. I love whether it's the writing of a show or performing something. So that takes priority. But do I like my creature comforts? Love my creature comforts. Have I ever asked anybody for a nickel? No. So if I want to buy a nice pair of shoes, I buy me a nice pair of shoes. If I want to live well, if that's my joy, And I would rather go to Wisconsin and work for that weekend and live well and be able to pick up a check for some friends. That's my priority, and I'm delighted to do it. So it's two-way, but art comes, or whatever you want to call it, the profession, the performing comes first.
Now, you mentioned that you had gone bankrupt, so that's one nightmare you've already lived through. When did that happen?
I never declared bankruptcy because I thought that was very naughty. And I hate these ads now that you see all the time. Bankruptcy is a new beginning. Oh, come off it. You owe everybody. Pay up, you idiot. But after Edgar committed suicide and I was fired from Fox, I couldn't get work for a year and a half. And, you know, the bills continue. And there's no money coming in. And you're selling stuff and you're cutting back. And it got very, very hairy there for a while. So you sell stuff. You go to Sotheby's and you sell. You kiss a couple of Fabergé frames goodbye, which killed me because they are my husband's. And you say so long, even though you're guilloché enameling and beautiful and the czar touched you.
Joan Rivers speaking with Terry Gross last June. She's the subject of the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Joan Rivers, recorded last June. The documentary, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, is now out on DVD and Blu-ray.
So, for you who want to perform all the time, does life not measure up to performing?
No. Life does not measure up to performing, and that's a brilliant question. No. No. Performing is perfect. Isn't it a perfect hour? You go on stage. They love you. They want to be there. You want to be there. You all work together to have a great evening. That's Laurence Olivier, the great English actor, once said, "That is my space." I met him once at a party. He said, "That is where I belong." Sinatra once said to me, "You see," he pointed at the stage in Vegas, "see that center spot? That's my life." Now, and I get it. It's perfect.
Some people who are great performers still get stage fright. Did you ever have that, or did you live to be on stage?
I live to be on stage, and I'm terrified, terrified before every show. Terrified to come and stand here with you. Always nervous. Always nervous. And I'm a super preparer.
So that's kind of a paradox to me, that you live to be on stage, and at the same time, there's this dread of being on stage.
Not a dread of being on stage, a dread of not doing well, of disappointing them. I have one friend who's a very good, very, very famous comedian, comic, who once said to me, "I give them 5 minutes, they don't like me, I go on automatic." And I thought, they have bought the ticket, they have paid for a babysitter, they have come out to see you. They want to have fun. I want them to walk out of a show and say, "That's the best show I've ever seen." I fight to the end. I worry to the end. Worry. Are they having a good time? Worry. When I had that heckler in Wisconsin, you know what I worried about? I was terribly upset about him because you understand that he's coming from a household that there's a deaf son and nobody can deal with it. But there were also, there was a 4,000-seat house. There were 3,999 other people that I did not want them walking away, not having a good time. I had to get that audience back. And that takes a lot to get an audience back.
I'm glad you said that. How did you get them back? Because this was a moment of uncharacteristic anger on stage.
Oh,
so
my darling.
Where do you go from there? Yeah.
You just start talking fast. And you start finding where will they start to relax and laugh again. And it's almost like, you know, you start a car and finally the motor goes. And it took me about 4 minutes to get them back. And then I did a little extra long show because I wanted them to walk out totally forgetting that and just going, "Wow, that was fun. And boy, that guy at the beginning, wasn't he something?" And that's what I did until I really felt they had a good time.
We were talking about your nervousness before going on stage. What's the worst thing that's ever happened to you on stage?
Worst thing that ever happened to me, once somebody died in Las Vegas.
In the audience?
That wasn't
in the
worst
audience?
Thing. In the audience. Oh, yeah, I've died several times on stage. But No. So that's not like the worst. But one of the worst, someone died, and it was at Caesar's Palace. They got that guy out so fast because they don't want anyone upset about anything. They high roller, and they rolled him out. The worst thing that happened to me on stage, someone had ran forward to tell me they loved me and projectile vomited all over the stage.
Oh, my God.
It was horrible. And I said to the audience, shall we continue or shall we or shall we clean the stage? And the audience said, let's continue. And I said, no, let's clean the stage.
Did they get on?
That was
did it get
horrible.
On you?
Oh, God, it got on everything. The orchestra was gagging. And when somebody starts to vomit, you know, everybody joins in.
Oh, no.
It was awful.
So what happened?
We stopped everything, and I right away, which is why I have to still work at 77, said, everyone had a drink on me, I'll be back. And everybody had a drink on Miss Rivers.
So what was the bill?
Oh, the bill was a couple of $1,000.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
My husband was still alive, and he said, are you crazy?
So did you have anything to wear when you took off the
dirty clothes? Oh, yes, you always have
clothes.
Several. You always have several Mackie gowns in the dressing room.
That's my motto.
Have at least 3 Mackie gowns. But it was all my shoes got, ugh, and they came forward to say, I love you.
So what's the first thing you said when you came back on stage?
I said, well, I brought out matches, so I was lighting matches. All the way out to get the smell out of the place. And then first thing I said is, because they brought, it was a woman, and they brought her backstage. I said, first of all, she's fine, and she's thinner. And I probably said, like, the bitch just lost 4 pounds, I'm so jealous. And then we just went on. But it's very, you never know what's going to happen in a live show.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Rivers. There's a new documentary about her, and it's called Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. In the movie, I think it's you who say it. I'm trying to remember whether you say it or somebody else says it, but I think you say that you were perceived as an advocate for plastic surgery, then the poster girl, and then the joke.
Yeah.
When did it cross over into joke?
Probably with my first bad plastic surgery. When I talked about it too much, I should have been like everybody else and not said a word and deny it.
So why did you talk about it?
They all do. I talked about it from the very beginning, but I'm a comedian. So, of course, you walk on stage and say, I just had my eyes done. And let me tell you, the doctor, blah, 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 blah. And you start doing jokes. And it was in those days shocking to talk about it. Like everything else, things have evolved. And that was a very shocking thing to discuss. And then it became, because I talked about it so much, that people thought, that's all I did. But I was very glad I talked about it. It goes back to what we started out talking about, which is by talking about it, maybe there's some woman somewhere in North Dakota who hates her nose. And she's, should I get it fixed? And all her friends are lying to her and saying, don't do it, Betty. And I'm saying, Betty, do it. You want to feel better about yourself? Do it.
So I want to play a clip from when you were on Nip Tuck. And Nip Tuck is the FX series.
Yes.
About two very like high-end plastic surgeons who do a lot of like famous people. And so you play yourself on this. And you come in and you're sitting with the plastic surgeons and they ask you their standard question, which is, what don't you like about yourself? And then you explain to them that you have a very kind of special, unusual request to make of them, and then you're not even going to tell them what that request is until they sign a confidentiality agreement in which they promise not to divulge what the surgery is until after you're ready to reveal it. And I'm going to play the clip in which you explain what the surgery is that you're going to request they do.
Well, it's not just my career. It's also my grandson, Cooper. We have the most amazing relationship. It's probably the most honest relationship I've ever had with anybody in my whole life. He loves me exactly the way I am.
So why change?
I'm a goddamn lie. Look,
I know I'm the one that brought plastic surgery into the mainstream. I know I'm the one that convinced all those thousands of housewives out there, if you don't like your face, then do something about it, change it. But now I want to send out a different message. My grandson is... he's so pure. He's so happy with himself the way he is. And I want him to stay that way. I don't want him to grow up hating the thought that he's going to get older. I don't want him to care if he gets acne at 20 or his hair starts to recede at 40. Just want him to know there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's the natural order of things. And boy, he'll get me some magazine cover. People, oh my God, before, after, no one's ever done something like that. It's gold. And I can use a cover. I haven't had one since 1994, those sons of... Come on, what about it? I am offering you the mother of all plastic surgeries. Will you do it?
That's Joan Rivers from a scene from Nip Tuck.
Nip Tuck.
So you know, I watched that clip, that scene, and it made me wonder, did you ever feel that way? Feel like, you know, maybe it's sending the wrong message to my grandson. You know, all the plastic surgery.
Are you kidding? The message to my grandson would be, get plugs for your hair and quick, get to a dermatologist and fix your skin. No. Get it planed. No. No, it's pure fiction.
No,
I do worry that I will die, go to heaven. God won't recognize me. Who are you?
I think a lot of performers are this amazing mix of ego and insecurity. And I'm wondering if you feel that you are.
I think I'm much more insecure than ego. But at this age, the ego is beginning. At this age, I really feel in my 70s now that I'm performing at the top of my game. That when you come to see me live, and I don't mean this, it sounds so egotistical. I think you're seeing the best you can see in women's comedy today. Or in comedy today. I think I'm performing just great live. I wouldn't have said that probably 6 years ago. Age frees you. So there is the ego with that. But the insecurity never stops. Never stops. I won't walk into a room if I don't know somebody. I ain't going in there. Uh-uh. I will never go any place alone. And as I said in some article recently, I am the hostess's nemesis, because they always think Joan will be funny at that end of the table. And Joan, if she doesn't know you, is the world's biggest bore at the end of the table.
You're a big bore if you don't know the person next to you?
If I don't know the people next to you, I'm not going to do a joke. I'm just not going to say anything.
Right.
I don't know who you are, and I'm not going to sit there and confide in you.
Joan Rivers speaking with Terry Gross last June. She's the subject of the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Joan Rivers, recorded last June. The documentary, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, is now out on DVD and Blu-ray.
In the documentary, you say about your late husband, Edgar, who had also been your manager and producer, you say, was I madly in love with him? No. Was it a good marriage?
No.
Yes. And I guess I was surprised to hear you confess that you weren't madly in love with him.
Well, it's also 20 years, and you can look back. I thought he was wonderful. I thought he was very funny. I thought he was so smart. I just knew he was right for me. I met him. I married him 4 days later. Four days later. He was crazy about me. I just knew he was perfect for me.
Perfect
and
in what way?
Perfect in every... smart, funny, terrific. Got the business, got me, had a great time together. Both wanted the same things. We had a great marriage. Great marriage. Was I madly in love with him? Thumpy, 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 thumpy? No. But as my mother always said, they should like you more than you like them. They worry where you are. Don't you have to worry so much where he is.
So was he thumpy-thumpy over you? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. He thought I was the cutest chickie walking around, but he had very bad eyesight.
So So I think most people know that, you know, he took his life after...
Killed himself, yeah.
Yeah, after, and this was not long. It was like a few months after your late night show, which he was producing on Fox, was canceled. And apparently the network asked him to leave. You opposed that, and then the whole show got canceled.
Yeah.
And you, in the movie, say that you blame Fox for...
Totally.
...for his death. But I guess I'm wondering if maybe he wasn't, like, depressed before that, and if maybe depression wasn't interfering with his relationship with the network, and if it all kind
of... If you're tap dancing, everything is wonderful, and something bad happens, you're not going to kill yourself. But this was the big thing, and he was producing the show, and they said to me, you can say he can go. He has to go. And he, I had the choice on a Thursday, and I said, no. Then I go with my husband, and we were off on Friday, and he knew what it did to my career. So he had not only gotten us out of a job, my whole career was smashed. Everything was just very, very bad. And he had had a major heart attack, and he had a four-way bypass, and he was coming out of that, and he was depressed over that, and he just couldn't continue, couldn't do it.
In the movie... You say that he left you high and dry and left you with a lot of debts because he wasn't a good businessman. And so it sounds like you were, you know, horrified that he killed himself, but also angry with him?
Beyond angry. Still am angry. I work very hard for suicide survivors, with suicide survivors, as does Missy, because what it does to you, the anger never leaves you. There's the sadness, there's the, that ennui that sets in, that, you know, when Melissa walked down the aisle, and it was 10 years after her father killed himself, we both cried because Daddy wasn't there to walk her down. I mean, you never get over that, missing that part of it. But you're still so furious what you did to us, what you did to your daughter, the selfishness of a suicide, and what you've done. You've just left all the pieces. And gone. You took the easy way. And it's not an easy way. They're very brave to do it. But it's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing what it does to a family. Terrible thing what it does to a family.
Do you feel like it sends a knowing message to the family?
It sends a bad message to the family, but it sends a lot of jokes if mommy's a comedian.
Right, yeah.
My first joke was my husband killed himself and left a message that I have to visit him every day, so I had him cremated and sprinkled him in Neiman Marcus. Now, haven't missed a day. And that's how I get through life, Terry.
Oh, gosh. Now, how do you think of something like that?
Because it's so... Life in the documentary, there's one scene when they show this girl that I bring a meal to from God's Love We Deliver that's sitting there in a chair with MS, or you never ask what it is. It's either MS or something very bad. And then we do a flashback and we show her on television as a hip, sharp New York reporter. And you realize life is so difficult and so cruel that you better laugh at it because you don't know what's going to hit you next.
Now, do you ever get senior moments on stage where you just kind of blank out for a second?
No, and that's a great question, and that terrifies me. The only time I ad-lib so much on stage and I mix my act around so much that sometimes I worry terribly, have I said that already? Because I am so free-form on stage that I wonder where I do two shows in one night. Have I already talked about death? Have I already talked about Melissa's giving birth and me being in the operating room? That's the only, I worry about things like that.
So one more thing. You've said that you think you're at the top of your game right now. But
in comedy, yeah.
In comedy. So if we took like second best, like what's another like favorite part of your career?
Anytime I've done a Broadway play, anytime I'm on a stage acting, it's just glorious. Whether it's doing a joke and you're all laughing with 5,000 people, that's a great moment. When you're all laughing, including me, that's just great. And the same thing, when I did say Broadway Bound, and I was, or Sally Marr that I was nominated for a Tony for a few years ago, when you do a moment with a whole audience is silent with you and you know you're all experiencing that, oh, this is why I was born.
Well, Joan Rivers, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Great talking with you again. Thank you so much.
Joan Rivers, speaking with Terry Gross last June. She's the subject of the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, which is now out on DVD and Blu-ray. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy new year. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.